Have you ever had a bad day? No? It may take former NBA star and current Phoenix television commentator Edward Arnett Johnson a long time to get over his bad day. Edward Johnson is 6'8" tall and 47 years old. He has a history of strong character, community service, working with children, giving motivational speeches. That's his life after his NBA career had ended. But another former NBA star, 6'2", 51-year-old Fast Eddie Johnson, was arrested in 2006 for sexual battery and burglary. Some media outlets around the country picked up the story and they confused the two men, resulting in a case of mistaken identity for Edward Johnson. Edward Johnson's phone started ringing off the hook with shocked friends and callers, many of whom who pointed accusing fingers at him for being perverted, sexual predator, and all kinds of nasty things. Johnson's day went really bad. The thing that disappointed me the most is some people were overzealous enough to think it was me and attack me with a ferocity I can't comprehend, Johnson said in a telephone interview from his home in Phoenix. That's the part that didn't allow me to sleep last night. That's the part that forced me to reach out to as many people as I could and say, shame on you, that's not me. That's not me. False accusations, people jumping to conclusions. Even people, family, friends, people who should know better, began to accuse him. How should we respond when people falsely accuse us and then, despite our best efforts, refuse to change or accept our corrections in any way? When we think they ought to know better and yet they jump to those conclusions about us as unfair and as untrue as they are. I mean, false accusations hurt, especially when we've done everything we can to correct those false accusations and people still believe them. And that's hard to handle. David in the Old Testament knew that reality in his life. And in fact, he wrote a psalm about it. It is Psalm 52. And we're looking at that psalm this morning. I think Psalm 52 makes a nice summary of the part of David's life that we have just finished studying in 1 Samuel. Because if there's anything that characterizes David's life in 1 Samuel and those early years with Saul, is the reality of living with false accusations. Saul falsely accused him. He lived his life on the run. He tried desperately to correct all the wrongs, and still it didn't work out. So Psalm 52, I think, is a nice summary from David's perspective of what we can learn during this part of his life. How did David deal with the false accusations? And that will help us as we deal with those who wrongly accuse us and treat us unfairly, even though we think they should know better. So let's take a look at Psalm 52 this morning. First of all, we must understand the source of the false accusations. Psalm 52, verse 1. Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? The loving kindness of God endures all day long. Your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor, O worker of deceit. You love evil more than good, falsehood more than speaking what is right. You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue. All right, let's refresh our memories regarding the event that inspired David to write this psalm. And we studied this event in 1 Samuel 22. King Saul tried to kill David. falsely accused him of conspiracy, tried to kill him. David ran for his life. He came to the priestly village of Nob and sought help from Ahimelech, the high priest, who gave him some bread to eat and the sword of Goliath for protection. There was a man there, Doeg the Edomite, who was lurking, and he observed that exchange with Ahimelech. Doeg reported the events to Saul, insinuating that David and Ahimelech conspired together against King Saul. Saul ordered the priests to present themselves at the palace. When they did, he ordered that they all be killed. Doeg carried out that order, killed all the priests. 85 priests he killed that day. And then he proceeded to go to the village. He killed all the people in the village, including women and children. And he razed the village. He burned it flat. All of that is the background for Psalm 52. If you look at the superscript of Psalm 52, we get a picture of the background. It says, "For the choir director, a maskil of David, when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul and said to him, 'David has come to the house of Ahimelech.'" So David wrote this psalm in the aftermath of that genocide, that horrible event, as he's running for his life from King Saul. Now, one of the basic questions is, who is David talking about in the psalm? When he says, "Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man?" He's starting an address. He's in his psalm, he's talking about an individual. Who is he talking about who is boasting in evil? Who is the subject of this psalm? Is David speaking about Doeg? Or is he speaking about King Saul in the psalm? Most writers think that David is speaking about Doeg, since he's mentioned in the heading. Of course, Saul is also mentioned in the heading of the psalm. The problem is that Doeg doesn't really fit the details of the psalm. Doeg could hardly be called a mighty man, except in sarcasm, which is how most commentators take it, that David is being sarcastic here. The term mighty man was a Hebrew expression that referred to nobility, to a warrior class of people. And Doeg was a shepherd. He was a lowly person in that culture and in that structure. He was not a nobleman. Secondly, Doeg did not actually falsely accuse David or Ahimelech. When you go back to 1 Samuel 22 and you read the story, he insinuated things, but he never made any actual false accusations in that story. They came from King Saul in 1 Samuel 22, not from Doeg. Third, the words that resulted in this whole atrocity came from Saul. That's who did all the speaking in 1 Samuel 22. That's who brought them in, the priests, and tried them and commanded that they be executed. And finally, Doeg could not be described later in this psalm as one who trusted in his riches, but King Saul certainly fit that description. So I would suggest to you that in this psalm, David is really talking about King Saul, not about Doeg. And this psalm then aptly summarizes David's experiences with Saul in 1 Samuel. And he is starting out by saying, "Why do you, King Saul, boast in evil, you mighty man, you warrior, you king, you nobleman?" Now, the emphasis in these verses is on the words that Saul spoke. But words are more than words. Saul's words spoken in the court with his servants resulted literally in some horrible atrocities taking place. Saul's words led directly to the killing of 85 men, their wives, their children, all of their livestock, and the burning flat of their village. It resulted in genocide. That's the power of words. So we must always be careful with words. I have the sense that we tend to think that words are not a big deal. We can say what we want. We can vent. We can sound off in anger and say all kinds of things. They're just words. We can later take them back. It's rhetoric. It's just words. and we can take those back and everything can go back to normal and everything can be fine. But in fact, that's not the way life works. Words stick longer in relationships than almost anything else we do. Those words sting a long, long time. Words are more than words, because words lead to actions. And as Christians, we need to be careful how we speak so that our words, even if our words are true, will not lead to evil actions as a result of our speech. Because that, in fact, happens. It happened with King Saul. So in our public discourse about morality in our society, for example, Christians need to be careful. We need to be circumspect how we speak in our world today. For it can result in evil actions being carried out. In our private talk with those we influence, we need to be careful what we say. Notice the words that are spoken in this passage. They're described here by David. Saul boasts in evil. Words spoken in pride lead to evil actions in our world. The tongue, he says, devises destruction. Saul's words led to the killing and destruction of a whole village of people. Words devour people, he says. Words are a form of cannibalism. That's really the metaphor that he's using. Words are deceitful. Saul was deceiving people. He was a con artist. That's what David is talking about here. Words eat people up. They consume them. They have horrible consequences in real life. They cannot be taken back once they are said. This is the real result of words spoken that are evil. Remember what James writes in the New Testament in James chapter 3? The tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue sets on fire the course of life and is set on fire by hell. The tongue is a restless evil full of deadly poison. That's somebody else's tongue, right? It's not yours, it's not mine. That's got to be describing somebody else, right? This is the reality of the tongue as the Bible looks at the tongue. There is that reality, that possibility in everyone's tongue. Now, King Saul, certainly, it applies to him. And the words that he spoke to Doeg the Edomite in 1 Samuel 22, they're a perfect illustration of James 3. And the fire, the evil that is set in motion by the words that people say. Furthermore, words are more than words because they reveal the heart of the one speaking. False words reveal false hearts. That's what David is saying in this psalm. Notice what Saul's words reveal about Saul's heart. Saul's words about David reveal that he loves evil more than good. That's more than words, isn't it? David is saying, your words show that you love evil more than you love good. Love evil more than good. That's a heart issue now. Your words are showing Saul that you love evil more than good. When people say evil words, it's not merely rhetoric. Evil words come from evil hearts. If we speak evil, it says that we really love evil, and conversely, that we don't love what is good, for we are speaking evil. We can't love what is good and speak evil. The two don't go together. You know, we can claim to be Christians, we can go to church, we can put on a good front, we can seem very righteous, but our words reveal what's in our hearts. And if they are evil words, if they are falsely accusing words, then they reveal that we don't love good, we love evil, no matter what image we try to portray. Saul certainly was a great con artist. He was able to portray a great image, but his words betrayed his heart. They revealed that he, David says, loved falsehood more than speaking what is right. Falsehood's not just a mistake in this case. Falsehood is a heart attitude in Saul. When people falsely accuse others while knowing the truth, then the false words reveal that they love the kinds of words that devour other people. That's their heart. That's our heart. We are cannibals with our words, and it comes from inside of us if that's the way we talk, even in anger, even in venting. We want to consume people, to eat them up. Our words can tell others much about our hearts. So listen to the words of people to find out about their hearts. What did Jesus say about our words in Matthew 12? He said, "You brood of vipers, how can you..." Jesus was not politically correct, was he? "You brood of vipers, how can you who are evil say anything good? For out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good man brings good things out of the good stored up in him. The evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in him. But I tell you that men will have to give account on the day of judgment for every careless word they have spoken. For by your words you will be acquitted, and by your words you will be condemned." That's powerful. That's scary. Every careless word, every vent. Acquitted or condemned by the words that reveal the heart. Our words reveal our hearts. What we say comes from who we are. Now remember, to whom was Jesus speaking when he said, "You brood of vipers"? He was talking to the religious leaders of his day, wasn't he? The righteous, supposedly. He wasn't talking to the irreligious. He wasn't talking to the pagans out there. He was talking to the religious people when he said that their words reveal what was really in their hearts. We can be very religious on the outside. And by the way, as we studied the life of Saul, he was very religious on the outside. He did all the sacrifices, right? And what did Samuel say to him? "To obey is better than sacrifice." You're doing all the religious stuff, Saul. You put on the great religious front. But to obey is better than sacrifice. The heart is more important. And your words, your false accusations, are really revealing what is in your heart. So, how do we handle those kinds of words that destroy, those kinds of words that falsely accuse? Well, first of all, we must understand the source of false accusations. We start there. That's where David started in this psalm. And then secondly, we must trust God's justice in God's time. Verse 5. "But God will break you down forever. He will snatch you up and tear you away from your tent and uproot you from the land of the living. And the righteous will see and fear, and will laugh at him, saying, 'Behold the man who would not make God his refuge, but trusted in the abundance of his riches, and was strong in his evil desire.'" Robert Bork, judge and former nominee for the Supreme Court, wrote, "God's plan made a hopeful beginning, but man spoiled his chances by sinning. We trust that the story will end with God's glory, but at present the other side's winning." Ever feel like that? Robert Bork certainly felt that way in 1987 when he was nominated to the Supreme Court by President Ronald Reagan, only to be falsely accused, to be vilified, to be crucified in the media, and ultimately rejected by the Senate for that Supreme Court position. In fact, the whole process produced a new expression in our language, which is still used today. When a person is borked, he or she is treated unfairly and falsely by those in authority. I mean, sometimes it can seem like falsehood is winning in our world, can't it? Sometimes it can seem like evil is getting ahead, is winning all the battles, and righteousness and good is losing. David certainly felt that way many times in the study we've just concluded in 1 Samuel. It looked like Saul was winning. Throughout that whole story till you get the end, it looks like Saul's winning all the time. That's why David ends up in the land of the Philistines, right? That's why he ends up in the wilderness, in the desert. Looked like Saul was winning the whole time till you get to the end of the story. David was losing, but Saul's whole life was being built on a falsehood. And David tried desperately, repeatedly, to correct that falsehood, didn't he? To no avail. Yet David knows better. These verses, composed while he is on the run, when unrighteousness seems to be winning, when sin and falsehood seems to be winning all the battles, David writes these words. And they are a statement of faith. They are a prayer for justice. The New American Standard translates these verses in the future tense, and I just read it that way, but God will break you down forever. He will snatch you up and tear you away from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous will see and fear. These are all future tenses in the New American Standard, but in fact, the Hebrew is probably better understood as a series of grammatically what we call optatives, which is a prayer request. It is an expression of a series of requests that David made. Remember, David is on the run here as he writes this psalm. He's praying here that God will exercise justice and judge Saul for his false accusations against David. So it would be better to translate these verses something like this: truly, may God bring you down. May God snatch you from the land of the living. May He uproot you. These are prayer requests. These are David's expressions of desire to God as he's on the run. David wants justice. David wants God to correct the false accusations. David is asking God to judge Saul for his unfair attacks on David. And he is trusting that God has the right to do that, not David. Remember, that's why David refused multiple times to kill Saul, even though he had the opportunity. Because it was not him who was supposed to correct the wrongs. Who was it? It was God who was supposed to correct the wrongs. And David was asking God to do that. And by asking God, he was trusting God, and he was putting his faith in God to correct it, not him, to take it into his own hands. Of course, every time David took it into his own hands, bad things happened in 1 Samuel, right? So David recognizes something in these verses. He recognizes that evil and good coexist in this world. That's true, isn't it? You look around, evil and good coexist side by side. Falsehood and truth live with each other every day of our lives. That's the way the world is. When we go to work, we work in a world where truth and lies coexist side by side. We live and work in a world where good and evil are neighbors. Every day we face that reality. That's life. It's not always fair, is it? How should we face this coexistence of good and evil, of falsehood and truth? We have to face it the same way that David faced it here. We must go to God in prayer. We ask God to assert His justice in our world. It's not our right to take it into our own hands. What did God say? Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. It's God's job, ultimately, to do that. So when you face falsehood at work, when you feel the sting of injustice in your life, You take it to the Lord like David in prayer, and you trust that God will one day correct all wrongs. God will one day bring injustice to justice. God will one day shine the light of truth on the lies that have been said about us. And you can trust God for that, for God is just as well as loving. So we live our lives trusting that God will right the wrongs done to us in His time. We trust God's justice in God's time. We don't know when that will be. In some cases, it may wait until eternity future, right? It may not happen in this life. We still trust God. In some cases, it happens as God turns things around in our lives. But when that time comes, David says, we will rejoice that God rights the wrongs of this world. We rejoice that those who place their faith in the wealth of this world and use that wealth to gain evil advantage over other people, to oppress them, to treat them unfairly and unjustly. We rejoice when those people are judged. We rejoice when everything is turned around on them. The con artists of this world will face God's justice, even sometimes in this life, and we can rejoice when that happens. So we rejoice when the Bernie Madoffs of this world are judged. Not because we are sadistic. Not because we want that person to hurt, but because justice wins a victory in that instance. That's good. And in the book of Revelation, we read that the people who were martyred for the Lord in the book of Revelation cry out, "How long, O Lord, till your justice comes? How long till things are made right?" And eventually we read later in the book of Revelation that when things are corrected by the Lord, they rejoice. They rejoice in God's justice reigning supreme. So Christians are a people of justice. We trust in God's justice. We trust that God will one day make all things right. And the false accusations and the lies that get said about you in this world, you can trust God that one day they'll be corrected. God knows, and you can trust Him. On June 17, 1966, two black men strode into the Lafayette Grill in Paterson, New Jersey, and they shot three people to death. Reuben Hurricane Carter, a celebrated black boxer and an acquaintance, were falsely charged. They were wrongly convicted of the murders in a highly publicized and racially charged trial back in the 1960s. Reuben Carter fiercely maintained his innocence for many, many years. And he, in fact, became his own jailhouse lawyer. And then a group of people came to believe that he was right, and they began to go to work for him. And finally, after serving 19 years, Reuben Carter was released, exonerated. He was wrongly convicted. Of course, it was made into a movie, as all these kinds of stories usually end up being. But as a free man, Carter reflected on how he had responded to injustice in his life. 19 years in prison. Longer than that in the entire process. So the question invariably comes up, and he is often asked, "Reuben, are you bitter?" And in answer to that, he says, "After all that's been said and done, the fact that the most productive years of my life, between the ages of 29 and 50, have been stolen, the fact that I was deprived of seeing my children grow up, wouldn't you think I would have a right to be bitter? Wouldn't anyone under those circumstances have a right to be bitter? In fact, it would be very easy to be bitter, but that has never been my nature or my lot to do things the easy way. If I have learned nothing else in my life, I've learned that bitterness only consumes the vessel that contains it. and for me to permit bitterness to control or to infect my life in any way whatsoever would be to allow those who imprisoned me to take even more than the 22 years they've already taken. Now that would make me an accomplice to their crime." Unquote. Not going to let bitterness take over, even though wrongly accused, wrongly jailed. David did not let bitterness consume him either. He understood the nature of Saul, and he turned to God and asked God to correct the injustices, and he committed himself to rejoicing in the day when God would and did. And that's how we have to live life, trusting that God will right those wrongs in His time. So don't let the bitterness for the wrongs of this world consume you. It will eat you up from the inside out. It really will. Turn to God in faith. Trust God that God will take care of those matters of justice at its time. Learn like Reuben Carter learned the third principle that David ends the psalm on, and that is live with an attitude of gratitude. Look at verses 8 and 9. "But as for me, I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the loving kindness of God forever and ever. I will give thee thanks forever because thou hast done it, and I will wait on thy name, for it is good in the presence of thy godly ones." So here's the principle. Thanksgiving is an act of faith. Every time we give thanks, it's an act of faith in God. In a world where evil and good coexist together side by side. David gave thanks to God, and he chose, he said, to wait on the Lord, didn't he? You like waiting? I don't. I want it corrected. I want it fixed. It's unfair. It's wrong. God, do it. Wait, David. Yes, wait. But I will wait on the Lord, and I will give thanks to God while I'm waiting. For him to correct what is wrong. For him to fix the unfair things of this life. And that gives us a vital principle, doesn't it, for living our lives every day. I mean, think about the first pilgrims in our country. They lived through that horrible winter, right? Where they dug more graves than they built houses. And yet, they also celebrated the first Thanksgiving that following harvest season. They chose to live with an attitude of gratitude. Thanksgiving is an act of faith. David said that he was like a green olive tree in the house of the Lord. Now, as he writes that, he's running away from the house of the Lord because he's being driven for his life. He's running for his life. He's being driven away from it. Yet he says, "I am like a green olive tree in the house of the Lord." The green olive tree, what a beautiful metaphor. The olive tree symbolizes a long and productive life. The olive tree can live for hundreds of years and can produce olive oil all of that time. David says, "I'm like an olive tree. I will live long and be productive, even though I'm living in the desert and I'm running for my life." That's faith. That's faith. David trusted in God's, he says, "I trust in your loving kindness. I trust in the loving kindness of God forever and ever." The word loving kindness is a great Hebrew expression, the chesed love, the loyal love of God. God is absolutely loyal to you. He has a loyal love for you and for me. And David says, "I will trust in the loyal love, the chesed of God forever and ever and ever. I may be living in the wilderness. I may be running for my life, but I trust in your loyal love for me, Lord." Can you say that? That's faith. That's a statement of faith. He said it, by the way, at the very outset of this psalm too. when in verse 1 he talks about, why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? The chesed, the loving kindness, the loyal love of God endures all day long, not you. I will trust in him. So David could give thanks even though life wasn't being good to David right now. It was an act of faith. It was John Henry Jowett back in the 1800s who said, gratitude is a vaccine, an antitoxin, and an antiseptic. It's a vaccine against the bitterness that would invade our souls. It inoculates us against that bitterness if we live with gratitude every day of our lives. It is an antitoxin that cleanses the soul when we feel bitter. And it is an antiseptic that fights the disease of bitterness and negativity in our lives. You know what? I wish I could package gratitude and give it out as a present to everyone that I meet. Wouldn't that be great? Somebody comes to my office and there is all of this stuff of life that is just tearing them apart. Here's the package. Just take it and it'll all be fixed. Take that pill of gratitude and you'll be all fixed. Because gratitude is that powerful. That's what David is saying here. I wish I could package it and take it myself sometimes. What a great and vital principle. So many are living in resentment and bitterness over past wrongs on people who have hurt us, people who have said stuff or not said stuff or done stuff or not done stuff in our lives, right? False accusations, all of that. Well, David knew it, but he didn't turn negative and critical in his own heart like it happens to so many, where all that negative and critical stuff just consumes people. He lived with gratitude. You know what? The people who are the most thankful people are the healthiest people in life. Instead of becoming negative and critical, we can live our days in thanks to God. And that really changes life. In 1993, Lieutenant Colonel Gary Morsch joined the Army Reserves as a doctor to care not only for U.S. soldiers, but also for wounded civilians, prisoners of war. In 2005, as a part of the war in Iraq, he was called up to serve as the field doctor for a battalion near the Iranian border. And in an article for Today's Christian, he shares a story of something that happened on the last day of his tour of duty in Iraq. The Saturday before I left Iraq was one of the most amazing days of my life, he writes. I was scheduled to see patients and make rounds at the POW camp, and I asked the chaplain to join me. I wanted to say goodbye to the prisoners. He goes on to say that many of these Muslim prisoners of war there in Iraq had become Christians through that process. And they were asking for a baptismal service. And so that day, on the spur, the chaplain decided to conduct a simple baptismal service. He says, we baptized about a dozen men that day in the prisoner of war camp there in Iraq. And during the baptisms, each man would ask them, or they would ask each POW, they would ask each man, each prisoner, what name he wished to take as his Christian name, because in a Muslim culture that name was significant, and so they would often change their name when they became a Christian. What Christian name would you like to take on? One prisoner asked him to list the names of the apostles so that he could pick one for himself as his Christian name. Another prisoner named Afshin asked Gary Morsch to suggest a name. He suggested James, the brother of Jesus, told him that his father and his brother were also named James, to which the prisoner asked about Morsch. Where did that come from? Not a Christian name, just a name. The chaplain, though, asked him to baptize Afshin. So he writes, I'm just going to read his words here. I asked my friend what name he wished to take. He said, I wish to take the name James Afshin Morsch. With tears in my eyes, I baptized my Muslim friend in the fellowship of Christ. After our baptismal service, James pulled me aside. He told me it was an Iraqi tradition to give a good friend a gift. He was so thankful. He so slowly slipped a ring off his hand. "This is my wedding ring," he said. "I haven't seen my wife in many years, and I probably will never see her again. I'd like to give it to you." I was stunned. "No, James, you must keep it," I eventually said. "Someday you will see your wife again." "No, I want you to have it," he said as he pressed the ring into my hand in thankfulness. We hugged and said a tearful goodbye, and then I walked out of the POW camp. It was time to return home. Now that's thanks. James Afshin Morsh has the spirit of David. The thankfulness of a faith in God, in a God who ultimately wins the battles of this world. Because right defeats might by faith in God. In 1991, the new owners of the Detroit Tigers fired their 73-year-old play-by-play announcer, Ernie Harwell, the voice of the Tigers for 3 decades he had worked there. Harwell was surprised and disappointed. He loved his job, and based on every indication, the people, the fans, loved him. 73 years old, had worked there for 30-plus years, fired just like that. Along with the broadcasting legends of Scully and Brickhouse, Buck and Carey, Harwell was well known. But the real measure of his greatness was seen after his firing. Rather than bad-mouthing the instigators of this action, Harwell practiced what he preached. You see, Ernie Harwell was a born-again Christian. The veteran announcer chose to accept the circumstances as God's will for his life and forgive those who had forced him out. "God blessed me by putting me here for 31 years, Harwell told the Detroit fans on the final day of the 1991 season. "I had the greatest job in the world, a job I love to do, but most of all, I appreciate you fans. I appreciate your loyalty, your support, and your love that you've shown me, especially the love." When asked later about his reaction to his dismissal, Harwell said, "I refuse to allow myself to be bitter. According to Romans 8:28, God causes the circumstances of our lives to work together for good. I had an assurance that he was in control and that I could trust him." That's David kind of faith, isn't it? For the next season, Harwell joined the broadcast team of the California Angels in Anaheim. He did well, but he missed the players and fans in Detroit. They missed him too. In fact, the fans would not let up in their demands that Harwell be returned to the Motor City in 1993. New ownership took over the Detroit Tigers and hired Ernie Harwell back. God has a way, doesn't he, of turning things around. Ernie Harwell continued to be the voice of the Tigers until he finally did retire in 2002. He hung up his earphones, his mic, for the final time at the age of 84 years old, still working. Harwell was honored by the Baseball Hall of Fame. He was elected the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame, the National Sportscasters and Sports Writers Association Hall of Fame, and the Radio Hall of Fame in 1998. In January of this year, the American Sportscasters Association ranked Harwell 16th on its list of top 50 sportscasters of all time in all sports. Yet here's what Ernie Harwell said about his life. "Even though I love baseball, I love my Lord Jesus Christ much more." That's the kind of faith that shakes this world. Father, teach us. Teach us to live with the faith of David, the faith of Ernie, and the thankfulness of James Afshin Morsh. As we deal with the evil and the injustices and the unfairness of this world in which we live. In Jesus' name, amen.